The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 20th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Republican leaders divided over Trump. What happened? A schism opened up within the Republican Party this week as lawmakers and officials began deciding whether or not to back Donald Trump as their presumptive presidential nominee. House Speaker Paul Ryan was the most powerful Republican to withhold his support, saying, "I'm just not ready to do that at this point." But Ryan didn't rule out a future endorsement and was scheduled to meet the billionaire in Washington to talk about their policy disagreements after the week went to press. Several senior Republicans flatly refused to support Trump, including former rival Jeb Bush, former Presidents George W. and George H.W. Bush, and former presidential nominee Mitt Romney, all of whom said they would not attend the Republican National Convention in July. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska led calls for a conservative to run as a third-party candidate. But many other Republicans rallied around Trump, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, and former presidential Senate nominee Senator John McCain, whose war record Trump has derided. "You have to listen to people that have chosen the nominee," said McCain. "It would be foolish to ignore them." Trump, who swept to unopposed victories in West Virginia and Nebraska on Tuesday, showed no signs of moderating his polarizing style. He sparked new controversy by again refusing to release his tax returns and by saying that as president, he might seek to reduce the U.S. debt by paying back a discount rate on the dollar, a proposal economists said would destroy U.S. credit and cause a financial crisis. Trump also trained his fire on likely Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, calling her crooked and an enabler of her husband's infidelity. Polls found support for Trump is building among Republican voters, and a Reuters IPSOS poll found that he'd surged 12 points among all voters in just a week and now trails Clinton only 41-40 nationally. What the editorial said. "This shouldn't be a hard decision for Republicans," said the Washington Post. "Endorsing an unprincipled and unprepared man to run the country is more dishonorable than breaking a partisan commitment. Ryan's fence-sitting is better than capitulation, but it's still nonsensical. He says Trump must show how he can appeal to all Americans, seemingly forgetting that this is a man who has attacked women in appalling terms, belittled Jews, Latinos, and others, proposed banning Muslims from entering the U.S., and threatened political opponents, the press, and the speaker himself. Not even Trump can walk all that back. Trump's bluster and boasting isn't always easy to stomach," said the Washington Times, "but the party elites need to swallow their disappointment and get behind him. He won't be another wipeout candidate like Barry Goldwater in 1964. Clinton is a weak opponent, and this race is clearly winnable. Beating her is far more important than clinging to conservative orthodoxy. If Trump doesn't act more like a genuine leader soon," said the Wall Street Journal, "he may find that his candidacy has imploded before he is even nominated. He was out of line, suggesting that Ryan should step down as chair of the Republican convention, and can no longer afford to issue Don Corleone-style threats to Republicans who don't bend to his will. If Trump continues to attack rebelling conservatives instead of wooing them, he'll only make it likely they'll run a third-party candidate, essentially guaranteeing another Clinton presidency. What the columnist said. The argument in favor of endorsing Trump is simple, said Greg Jones in DailyCaller.com. With the Middle East in turmoil, the economy anemic, and as many as 4 Supreme Court seats potentially coming up for grabs, the country can ill afford 4 years of an increasingly left-leaning Hillary Clinton. If Trump offers conservatives specific assurances on policy issues and names his potential Supreme Court nominees, he should be able to convince them he's not the wolf in sheep's clothing they think he is. Vichy Republicans who are collaborating with Trump will come to regret it, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. He is incapable of becoming more presidential. In the heat of the campaign, Trump will succumb to his gut instincts and lash out with vicious smears, bigoted insults, and misogyny. Principled conservatives should refuse to endorse him if they don't wish to be tainted by the disgrace of a Trump candidacy. Republicans on the ballot this November are stuck in a catch-22, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. If they support Trump, they risk being associated with his reprehensible proposals and verbal outbursts. But if they refuse, that weakens Trump and brings down the whole ticket, including, of course, them. It would be possible to justify support for Trump if he merely promised a period of chaos for conservatism, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. But electing this brazenly ignorant, demagogic authoritarian would threaten the health of our economy, the civil peace of our society, and the stability of an increasingly perilous world. We conservatives can survive 4 years of Clinton, especially if she's held in check by a Republican Congress, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. But if an isolationist, know-nothing John Bircher marches into the White House under the Republican banner, it would cripple the conservative cause for a generation. And a second main story. Obama battles North Carolina over bathroom law. What happened? The clash over transgender bathroom use escalated into a major civil rights battle this week as North Carolina and the Obama administration filed dueling federal lawsuits over a state law requiring transgender people to use public bathrooms corresponding with their sex at birth. Last week, the Justice Department gave Republican Governor Pat McCrory until May 9th to stop enforcing the law known as HB 2, saying it was discriminatory. McCrory responded by filing suit, calling the legislation common sense privacy policy and accusing the government of overreach. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch then countersued, likening HB 2 to Jim Crow laws and assuring transgender Americans, "We will do everything we can to protect you." North Carolina stands to lose more than $4 billion in federal education aid over the law. What the columnist said. HB 2 is unquestionably unconstitutional, said Garrett Epps in TheAtlantic.com. Aside from its bathroom provisions, the law also invalidates local ordinances protecting LGBT people and prohibits new ones. That clearly violates a standard set in 1996 when the Supreme Court overturned an anti-gay law because it seemed motivated by animus toward the class it affects. Here, the stench of animus assails the nostrils. President Obama is on a crusade to enforce progressive morality, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. His administration declares a man can be a woman and vice versa, then compels 300 million of us to accept it. When a state law is more liberal than a federal law, say, on immigration, Obama lets it slide. But if a state dares to disagree with him, it feels the full force of the Justice Department. The feds may be overreaching, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, but North Carolina's decision to wage war over bathrooms is political madness. Polls show Americans have moved on from the culture wars over sexual orientation. This folly could badly damage the GOP in the divided state and tarnish the national Republican brand. McCrory, who looks likely to lose his re-election bid in November, ought to have his head examined. Our controversy of the week, Trump. Could he actually beat Clinton? The bad news, said Peter Beinart in The Atlantic, is that the Republican Party is about to nominate the most dangerous presidential nominee in American history. The good news is that for all his astonishing success so far in exploiting white racial resentment, anti-immigrant fervor, and Islamophobia, Donald Trump is not going to beat Hillary Clinton in November. It comes down to simple math, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. To stand any chance of winning, Trump would have to earn some 3 million more votes than Mitt Romney did 4 years ago and capture nearly all of the swing states. Yet the bombastic businessman begins the general election race as the most unpopular nominee in 30 years of polling, with an unprecedented 70% disapproval rating among women and a staggering 87% disapproval rating among Hispanics. Even many Republicans say they can't vote for him. Factor in the Democrats' huge structural advantage in the Electoral College. If Hillary Clinton merely takes all the usual blue states, she will need only one or two swing states, such as Florida, to become our next president. And the picture looks even clearer. Donald Trump isn't going to win. Forget the old electoral map, said Ben Geer in Fortune.com. Unlike the patrician Mitt Romney, Trump is campaigning as an economic populist. If he hammers home his pledge to bring jobs back from overseas, painting Clinton as a pro-NAFTA free trader, Trump could sweep the traditionally Democratic Rust Belt states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Ohio, as well as Iowa and Missouri. If he pulls that off, he wins the election. Remember, pundits and political analysts were just as certain that Trump couldn't win the Republican nomination, said Keith Burris in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. What they don't understand is that Trump is not leading a typical campaign, but a movement of Americans who are desperately unhappy with the direction of the country. Like Ronald Reagan, once dismissed as an amiable dunce, Trump viscerally connects with voters. We dismiss him at the risk of missing what is happening in America. The general election is a whole different ballgame than the Republican primary, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Trump has yet to put together the ground operation or the donor support he'll need against the well-organized, well-funded Clinton machine. And anyone who thinks he can learn in 6 months how not to appear sexist or racist must have missed his celebration of Cinco de Mayo last week. A tweeted photo of the candidate eating a taco bowl above the cringeworthy caption, "I love Hispanics." Trump will not only lose, said Anthony Goggin in Salon.com. He will turn some red states blue and get crushed in a historic rout. Utah, for example, hasn't voted for a Democratic president since 1964. But thanks to Trump's vulgarity and marital history, which play poorly with the large Mormon population, state polls show him trailing Clinton. No Republican who loses Utah is going to get anywhere near the White House. I hope I'm wrong, said Matthew Tully in the Indianapolis Star, but I think Trump is still being underestimated. His message of Make America Great Again is the clearest, most easily digestible of any we've seen in a long time in presidential politics. And in politics, a simple message is better. Unlike Clinton, Trump is compelling, funny, and larger than life. And Americans have a long history of choosing the candidate who is more comfortable in his or her own skin. Say what you will about Donald Trump, he is supremely comfortable playing himself, and in November, he might actually pull this off. It was a good week for Benjamin and Harper, which cracked the list of top 10 baby names for the first time, supplanting Daniel for boys and Madison for girls. Noah and Emma remain the top picks for newborns for the second straight year. It was a good week for bison after President Obama officially designated the free-roaming shaggy natives of the Great Plains as the country's official mammal, giving buffalo, as they're also called, the same symbolic status as the American bald eagle. And it was a good week for moving to Canada, after the dating site Maple Match launched a new marketing campaign promising to make it easy for Americans to find the ideal Canadian partner to save them from the unfathomable horror of a Trump presidency. But it was a bad week for Queen Elizabeth II, who was caught on camera during a garden party saying that Chinese officials had been very rude during a state visit to the UK by President Xi Jinping. The British government is eagerly trying to boost trade ties with China. It was a bad week for kids, after a survey found that nearly one-third of British youngsters entering school lack basic social skills, with teachers blaming parents' obsession with smartphones. There is limited parent-child interaction, one teacher said. And it was a bad week for heads-up play, after PGA golfer Zach Blair, frustrated that he missed a birdie putt on the fifth hole at Wells Fargo Championship, hit himself on the head with his putter, slightly bending the shaft and resulting in automatic disqualification on the next hole for using a non-conforming club. While we're here, there's a short, boring but important piece. New e-cigarette rules. The Food and Drug Administration unveiled tough new regulations for the e-cigarette industry last week, banning sales of the devices to anyone under 18 and requiring warning labels on e-cigarette packages. Sales of e-cigarettes and vaporizers have surged in recent years, and more than 3 million middle and high school students vaped in 2015, a tenfold increase since 2011. E-cigarette advocates argue that the devices, which heat liquid nicotine into an inhalable vapor, are healthier than traditional cigarettes because they don't contain cancer-causing tobacco or tar. But critics say the long-term health and addiction risks of vaping are unknown. Under the new rules, manufacturers will have to register with the FDA and apply for permission to sell their products. We're on the briefing page now. The new war on cancer. The Obama administration has launched a moonshot to cure cancer. What are the chances of success? Has there been progress on cancer? 45 years after Richard Nixon declared war on the disease, cancer remains the number two killer in the U.S. after heart disease. This year alone, an estimated 600,000 Americans will die of cancer. Attempts to find a magic pill, a global cancer treatment for hundreds of types of cancer, have failed. but more sophisticated forms of treatment targeted to specific kinds of cancer cells have resulted in much better survival rates for some common cancers, including breast, prostate, and colon cancer, and some forms of leukemia. And recently, researchers have had very encouraging results with a new approach called immunotherapy. Some patients in advanced stages of the disease, who previously would have been deemed terminal, have undergone rapid and complete recoveries. Hoping to build on that progress, President Obama in January announced a $1 billion moonshot to cure cancer, putting Vice President Joe Biden, whose son Beau died of brain cancer last year, in charge of mission control. Biden believes a major breakthrough is possible. "We're not looking at incremental change," the vice president said. "What we're trying to do is end up with a quantum leap on the path to a cure." How does immunotherapy work? Unlike traditional cancer treatment methods that attack the cancer itself, surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, immunotherapy works by encouraging the patient's own immune system to fight the disease. The immune system often fails to mount a successful attack on cancer because tumors that develop from the body's own healthy cells aren't recognized as invaders. Some tumors even have ways of tricking the immune system into ignoring them. One type of immunotherapy transfers genetically engineered killer T cells back into a patient's body. These super aggressive antibodies target and destroy the tumor. In another type, drugs known as checkpoint inhibitors block the cancer cells from turning off the usual T cell defenses, enabling the body to fight the disease. Patients respond to these drugs because their immune system is ready to go, but the tumor is protecting itself, said Dr. Antoni Ribas, professor of medicine at University of California, Los Angeles. "For these patients, we just need to unleash the immune system." What success has it had? In one trial, 93% of patients suffering from certain types of B-cell leukemias and lymphomas saw their cancers disappear. California businessman Johnny Crowell took part in another immunotherapy trial of just 10 patients after developing a rare Merkel cell cancer. "Doctors had already told him that the cancer would end up in my lungs, brain, back," Crowell told The Atlantic. He was given 2 years to live. After Crowell took G100, a drug that increases the body's immune response, doctors found no signs of cancer in any of the tissue they extracted from his body. Are there downsides? Plenty, unfortunately. Immunotherapy drugs can cost up to $150,000 per year, and most people can get access to them only if they're accepted into very small clinical trials. Moreover, it's not clear whether immunotherapy will work with all cancers. The treatment seems to work best against cancer cells with high levels of genetic mutation, making the tumors more easily identifiable, as in lung cancer, where carcinogens and tobacco smoke trigger mutations. In diseases with fewer mutations, such as pancreatic cancer, immunotherapy seems to be far less effective. Since Nixon launched his campaign to cure cancer back in the 1970s, researchers have repeatedly run into the same obstacle. Cancer is really not one disease, but at least 300, involving different types of cells with abnormal genetic machinery that makes them grow out of control. "This is the emperor of all maladies," said Professor Charles Swanton from the University College London's Cancer Institute. "We're dealing with an entity that's constantly evolving, constantly adapting, and constantly changing its genome." What about other treatments? Another promising new frontier is genetic analysis, which splits each type of cancer into dozens of subtypes, so that the specific chemotherapy drugs can be tailored to each cancer. Experts also now hope they can use the breakthrough gene editing technique called CRISPR to correct mutations in cancer cells, or perhaps edit out mutation-prone genes that people inherit. Will the moonshot really help? Biden's task as mission commander is to marshal all of these varied efforts into one coordinated response, bringing together researchers, philanthropists, big pharma, and insurers. Biden's biggest challenge is to try to tackle what he calls the cancer politics, the infighting and jealousy that occur between cancer researchers, who often refuse to share their data with one another. The federal effort will also fund research into how different immunotherapy treatments work in combination with one another, as well as efforts to improve prevention and early detection. Just don't expect a single magical breakthrough. The war on cancer will not be won in one dramatic battle, says MIT cancer researcher Robert Weinberg. It will be a series of skirmishes. Jimmy Carter's miraculous recovery. In August 2015, former President Jimmy Carter announced he had been diagnosed with advanced melanoma, a type of skin cancer that had spread to his liver and brain. "I'm perfectly at ease with whatever comes," said Carter, then 90. 4 months later, Carter announced he was cancer-free. Along with radiation, Carter had been put on pembrolizumab, brand-named Keytruda, a checkpoint inhibitor that stops cancer cells from blocking the immune system's response. Soon after, Carter's scans showed no evidence of the original cancer lesions on his brain or any new lesions. Given that cancer can often reappear years down the line, oncologists prefer to talk in terms of years of remission rather than cure. But like Carter, some cancer patients on Keytruda have seen their disease disappear completely. Not surprisingly, says melanoma specialist Dr. Patrick Ott, Carter's miraculous recovery has prompted patients across the country to demand, "I want what Jimmy Carter had." Doctors caution that in clinical trials, Keytruda shrank the tumors in only 24% of patients, and that it only works on certain types of cancer. We'll look at the columns now. Two this week from the U.S. First, how voters actually make choices. Science can tell us lots about how voters will make their decisions in 2016, says Robert Sapolsky. What it tells us, unfortunately, is that subterranean, unconscious forces are constantly percolating up to influence our decision making. In evaluating political candidates, studies show voters place an outsized emphasis on appearances and gut feelings. One study found that candidates judged to look more competent, regardless of their positions, won elections 68% of the time. Other studies have found that voters tend to choose the candidate independently rated to be better looking. In his study of Australian elections, the winner 80% of the time was the candidate who used more collective pronouns, we and us. Perhaps the most striking study was one in which kids age 5 through 13 were shown photos of candidates from obscure elections and asked which one they would pick to serve as captain on a long sea voyage. The kids picked the real-world winner of the elections a boggling 71% of the time, just based on their feelings about the would-be captain's appearance. Who will win this year? To make an educated guess, just remember to free yourself of the idea that humans are rational beings. When liberal empathy disappears, my fellow liberals suffer from an arrogance problem, said Nicholas Kristof. When I recently wondered on my Facebook page whether universities are undermining intellectual diversity by shunning conservatives and evangelical Christians in the hiring of professors, I was swamped with scornful reactions. Truth has a liberal slant, wrote one commenter. Said another, how about we make faculties more diverse by hiring idiots? Progressives have great empathy for war victims in other countries, for the poor, even for abused chickens. But for conservative intellectuals and religious people, nothing but contempt. This blinkered viewpoint undoubtedly explains why Republicans make up only from 6 to 11% of professors in the humanities and social sciences. These percentages are partly a product of discrimination. One study found that one-third of social psychologists would likely reject a conservative job candidate, while more than half of anthropologists and English professors would hesitate to hire an evangelical. For progressives who champion diversity, this is a huge blind spot. When students get just one perspective on the world, classrooms become echo chambers. And this from the United Kingdom. A Muslim mayor for London. London has become the first great Western city to choose a Muslim as its mayor, said the Mail on Sunday in an editorial. Sadiq Khan of the opposition Labour Party defeated conservative rival Zach Goldsmith resoundingly last week, 57% to 43%, to win the largest personal mandate of any politician in UK history. The son of a Pakistani bus driver, Khan grew up in public housing and rose to become a human rights lawyer and member of the parliament. That he could be chosen to lead London is a great declaration of open-mindedness by a great city, and the best answer we could possibly give to intolerant voices of extreme Islam. Khan has pledged to be a mayor for all Londoners, and he showed that with his first act of being sworn in, when he attended a Holocaust memorial ceremony and met with Britain's chief rabbi, Ephraim Mirvis. It was an ugly campaign, soaked in racism, said Owen Jones in The Guardian. Goldsmith shamelessly exploited anti-Muslim prejudices in an effort to secure a shameful victory. He accused Khan of supporting militant Islamic extremists and targeted Hindu and Sikh voters with pamphlets warning them against electing a Muslim. It was all nonsense. Khan is a progressive Muslim and has received death threats from jihadists for voting in parliament in support of gay marriage. His campaign team included gay men and Jewish women. Goldsmith deserves to be held in contempt, as does Prime Minister David Cameron, whose office orchestrated, licensed, and directed this campaign. The Tories as a whole are collectively responsible, and it must never be forgotten. It's not Islamophobic to ask questions about Khan's dubious record, said Toby Young in The Spectator. He shared a platform with five radical Islamists in 2004, including a supporter of the Palestinian terror group Hamas. 2 years later, he signed an open letter that partly blamed terrorist incidents, such as the 2005 London bombings, on British foreign policy, particularly Britain's support for Israel. Should we ignore these facts just because he's a Muslim? But after this victory, Khan seems destined for national leadership, said the Sunday Express. Aside from the London race, the local elections held across the UK last week were an unmitigated disaster for Labour. And that reflects on party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Thanks partly to an ongoing scandal about anti-Semitism in its ranks, Labour had its worst performance in Scotland in a century, lost its majority in Wales, and lost council seats in England. Corbyn represents only the far-left wing of the party, which includes many radicals obsessed with Israel. Khan, by contrast, comes from the working class and knows their needs. But before he sets his sights on the Labour leadership, Khan has a big job to do, said Evening Standard. London's population continues to swell. The city is now home to 8.6 million people, placing enormous stress on public services. All Londoners should wish him the very best of luck for his mayoralty. He's going to need it. And before we move on from this page, I spotted a "It must be true, I read it in the tabloids" short that I wanted to share with you. An Israeli man requested a restraining order against God, saying that he's fed up with the Almighty interfering in his life. David Shoshin told a court in Haifa that God started to treat me harshly and not nicely 3 years ago, and calls to the police had not put an end to the harassment. Judge Asan Kanan denied the request for the restraining order, saying Shoshin needed the kind of help the court could not provide. God did not present himself at the hearing. And now the last word. Caught in digital hell. For a decade, the owners of a Kansas farm have been inundated with accusations that they are online scammers and identity thieves. The root of the problem, says journalist Kashmir Hill, is an internet mapping glitch. An hour's drive from Wichita, in a little town called Potwin, there is a 360-acre piece of land with a very big problem. The plot has been owned by the Vogelman family for more than 100 years, though the current owner, Joyce Taylor, née Vogelman, 82, now rents it out. The acreage is quiet and remote, a farm, a pasture, an old orchard, two barns, some hog shacks, and a two-story house. It's the kind of place you move to if you want to get away from it all. The nearest neighbor is a mile away, and the closest big town has just 13,000 people. It is real rural America. In fact, it's a two-hour drive from the exact geographical center of the United States. But instead of enjoying their place of respite, the people who live on Joyce Taylor's land find themselves in a technological horror story. For the past decade, Taylor and her renters have been visited by all kinds of mysterious trouble. They've been accused of being identity thieves, spammers, scammers, and fraudsters. They've gotten visits from FBI agents, federal marshals, IRS collectors, ambulances searching for suicidal veterans, and police officers searching for runaway children. They've found people scrounging around in their barn. The renters have been doxxed, their names and addresses posted on the internet by vigilantes. Once, someone left a broken toilet in the driveway as a strange, indefinite threat. All in all, the residents of the Taylor property have been treated like criminals for a decade. And until I called them last month, they had no idea why. To understand what happened to the Taylor farm, you have to know a little bit about how digital cartography works in the modern era. In particular, a form of location service known as IP mapping. IP refers to an internet protocol address, which is a unique identifier assigned to a computer or a computer network. IP addresses play an essential role in computers talking to each other, and every internet-connected device needs one. When you visit a website, servers write down your device's IP address and keep it in their records. Sometimes, through some sophisticated sleuthing, you can find out more information about a specific IP address. For example, whether it's been associated with a malicious device or where in the world it's located. The trouble for the Taylor farm started in 2002 when a Massachusetts-based digital mapping company called MaxMind decided it wanted to provide IP intelligence to companies that wanted to know the geographic location of a computer in order to, for example, show its user relevant ads, or send a warning letter if the user was pirating music or movies. there are lots of different ways a company like MaxMind can try to figure out where an IP address is located. It can war drive, sending cars around the U.S. looking for open Wi-Fi networks, getting those networks' IP addresses, and recording physical locations. It can gather information via apps on smartphones that note the GPS coordinates of the phone. It can look at which company owns an IP address and then make an assumption that the IP address is linked to that company's office. But IP mapping is not an exact science. At its most precise, an IP address can be mapped to a house. At its least precise, it can be mapped only to a country. In order to deal with that imprecision, MaxMind set default locations at the city and state levels for IP addresses that were roughly known. For IP addresses known only to be somewhere in the U.S., the locator would point to the center of the country. As any geography nerd knows, the precise center of the United States is in northern Kansas, near the Nebraska border. Technically, the latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates of the center spot are 39 degrees 50 minutes north, 98 degrees 35 minutes west. In digital maps, that number is an ugly one, 39.833333, negative 98.585522. So back in 2002, when MaxMind was first choosing the default point on its digital map for the center of the U.S., it decided to clean up the measurements and go with a simpler nearby latitude and longitude, 38 degrees north, 97 degrees west, or 38.0, negative 97.0. As a result, for the past 14 years, every time MaxMind's database has been queried about the location of an IP address in the United States it can't identify, it has spat out the default location of a spot 2 hours away from the geographic center of the country. This happens a lot. 5,000 companies rely on MaxMind's IP mapping information, and in all, there are now more than 600 million IP addresses associated with that default coordinate. If any one of those IP addresses is used by a scammer, or a computer thief, or a suicidal person contacting a helpline, MaxMind's database places it at the same spot, 38.0, negative 97.0, which happens to be in the front yard of Joyce Taylor's house. The first call I got was from Connecticut, Taylor told me. It was a man who was furious because his business internet was overwhelmed with emails. His customers couldn't use their email. He said it was the fault of the address at the farm. That's when I became aware that something was going on. This was back in 2011. Taylor, who grew up on the farm and remembers the day when she was 15, when the house first got an indoor bathroom, has a gateway computer but doesn't use the internet often. I use it to write letters and Sunday school lessons, she said. When I first called her, she refused to talk to me because she's had so many crazy callers over the years. My parents had a golden reputation. My family has always been beloved in this community, she told me later. We've never had enemies. But over the next several months, the calls and visits intensified. When law enforcement agents asked companies like Google and Facebook for the IP addresses used by suspected criminals and then mapped them using tools that relied on the MaxMind database, the locator pointed to the Taylor house. Amateur sleuths who spotted IP addresses used by visitors to their websites or on message forums were so convinced that the Taylor house was the source of their various problems that they created reports about it on Facebook, YouTube, Reddit, the Ripoff Report, and Google+. Even today, if you Google the house's address, it returns a series of websites detailing nefarious activities. The harassment continued to the point where the local sheriff had to intervene. He placed a sign at the end of the driveway warning people to stay away from the house and to call him with questions. That poor woman has been harassed for years, Butler County Sheriff Kelly Herzit told me. Herzit said that his department's job had become to has become to protect the Taylor House from other law enforcement agencies. Our deputies have been told this is an ongoing issue, and the people who live there are nice, non-suicidal people. Last year, I discovered a young couple in Atlanta that suffered from a similar but less severe issue. Since the couple moved into their home a year ago, dozens of strangers have visited looking for lost and stolen smartphones. The visitors are led there by Find My Phone apps that say the phones are located inside the house. They aren't. While helping the couple try to figure out their mystery, I teamed up with the podcast Reply All and a security researcher named David Maynor. When Maynor visited the house to investigate, he discovered that it was one of the only houses in the neighborhood with a router and Wi-Fi. The couple lived in a digital desert, and because of the way some location mapping programs seek out permanent networks in the area to act as an anchor, lots of IP addresses were getting attached to the house. After I published that story, I began wondering if there were other homes in the country like it. I asked Maynor if there was a way to find out, and he said he could build a program that would crawl through a public MaxMind database of mapped IP addresses to see if there were physical locations that appeared repeatedly. Within a couple of days, he sent me a spreadsheet with thousands of home addresses along with the number of IP addresses attached to them. The Taylor home was at the very top of the list. The 600 million IP addresses attached to the home were an order of magnitude higher than any other location. The Atlanta home was number 865 on the list. I told Thomas Mather, the co-founder of MaxMind, about Joyce Taylor's story. I asked him if he knew anything about the default coordinates that were placing unidentified IP addresses on the Taylor property. Mather told me via email that the default location in Kansas was chosen over 10 years ago when the company was started. At that time, we picked a latitude and longitude that was in the center of the country, and it didn't occur to us that people would use the database to attempt to locate people down to a household level, he wrote. We have always advertised the database as determining the location down to a city or zip code level. To my knowledge, we have never claimed that our database could be used to locate a household. But many people do use it that way. 5,000 companies draw information from MaxMind's database, and most casual internet users don't know anything about IP mapping defaults. They just know that when a website tells them that their scammer lives in Pottstown, Kansas, they get in the car and go. Mather told me he hadn't realized until I emailed him that his IP mapping had caused problem for Taylor and her tenants, but he sounded sympathetic. Until you reached out to us, we were unaware that there were issues with how we selected these latitudes and longitudes, Mather wrote me in his email. We do take this issue seriously, and we are working to resolve it as quickly as possible. The physical mapping of computer addresses is one of the many aspects of the internet infrastructure that is almost completely unregulated. It is a task performed by private companies, and not just MaxMind. No one is officially in charge, and so there was no obvious party that Joyce Taylor could go to in order to find out why this was happening or to get the problem fixed. There are lots more of these phantom IP houses. When Maynor sent me that list of thousands of locations in the MaxMind database that have an aberrantly high number of IP addresses associated with them, a colleague and I called dozens of them. Many residents had remained blissfully unaware that they were living in an IP flood zone. They'd never had strangers show up on their doorsteps. Apparently, the IP addresses attached to their homes hadn't yet been used for anything nefarious. Yet. One important lesson of my sleuthing is that IP addresses, which get used as digital evidence in criminal trials and to secure search warrants, are not always reliable. Like Social Security numbers, they comprise a numerical system built for one purpose and now used for something completely different. Social Security numbers were designed to keep track of people's lifetime earnings, but they're now the security token used to lock down a person's entire identity. IP addresses were meant to allow computers to talk to each other, but they've been repurposed to reveal details about the people behind those computers. The word security and address in their titles promise more than they can deliver. Now that I've made MaxMind aware of the consequences of the default locations it's chosen, Mather says the company is picking new default locations in the middle of bodies of water rather than near people's homes. I asked Mather how soon all of the companies that use its IP mapping database will update the information in their own database. I'd say the typical customer updates the data every week, but that can vary, said Mather. Some customers only update every few months. MaxMind refreshed its database the following weeks. The Taylor Farm will hopefully be a quiet place again sometime soon. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Fusion.net. We're on the health and science page now. The first article is Why Bacteria Are Becoming Drug Resistant. Some people suffering from bronchitis, flu, and other ailments often leave their doctor's office with a prescription for antibiotics, even though in many cases it will do nothing to help them. Nearly one-third of the antibiotics taken in this country are unnecessary, says the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, despite decades of warnings that overprescribing is helping fuel the alarming surge in drug-resistant superbugs. All told, the study found, some 47 million unwarranted antibiotic prescriptions are being written out each year. Many of them are for viral illnesses the drugs can't treat, such as colds and sore throats, or for sinus infections, typically caused by fungi that aren't affected by antibiotics. The researchers say it's likely they've even underestimated the problem because they don't consider antibiotics doled out over the phone and in urgent care centers or cases in which doctors prescribe the wrong antibiotic to treat a genuine bacterial infection. The danger of overprescribing is that once bacteria are exposed to an antibiotic, they start learning how to outsmart it, rendering that drug less effective or even useless. More than 2 million people a year are infected by drug-resistant germs, and some 23,000 die of their infections. If inappropriate antibiotic use continues, CDC Director Tom Frieden tells NBCNews.com, we'll lose the most powerful tool we have to fight life-threatening infections. The benefits of calorie cutting. Even if you're not seriously overweight, there's a lot to be gained by cutting back on calories, including sounder sleep, a better sex life, and more overall happiness, new research suggests. Researchers asked a group of 218 people with generally healthy weights to either reduce their caloric intake or continue to eat as they normally would for a period of 2 years. During that time, the participants completed detailed questionnaires about the quality of their life. Those who ate normally experienced virtually no weight change, but the people who curbed calories by 12% on average not only lost an average of 17 pounds, but also reported brighter moods, better sleep, friskier libidos, and an improved quality of life. Lead author Corby Martin tells CBS News that calorie restriction produces a wide range of positive biological and physiological changes, including lower blood sugar and improved cholesterol and blood pressure. And the health scare of the week, deadly medical mistakes. Medical errors in hospitals and other healthcare facilities are now the third leading cause of death in the United States, claiming more lives each year than respiratory disease, accidents, stroke, and Alzheimer's disease. After analyzing four large studies investigating death rates, researchers at Johns Hopkins University calculated that mistakes ranging from undetected complications to medication mix-ups are responsible for more than 250,000 deaths a year. It boils down to people dying from the care that they receive rather than the disease for which they are seeking care, study leader Martin McCary tells The Washington Post. The researchers argue that federal mandates should be revised to require doctors to disclose medical errors that resulted in a preventable death. When a plane crashes, we don't say this is confidential proprietary information, McCary says. We consider this part of public safety. Hospitals should be held to the same standards. And a few short notes as we wind down the hour. Americans who voted for Donald Trump in the Republican primary so far amounted to only 4.7% of all eligible voters in the country, according to a calculation by the organization Fair Vote. The rising deaths from opioid overdoses is fueling a surge in the number of organ donations. The share of organ donors who died of drug overdoses jumped by nearly 270% between 2006 and 2015. Last year, one out of 11 organ donors were drug overdose victims. Taylor Swift was officially the highest paid musician of 2015, bringing in $73.5 million, including $61.7 million from touring. Other top earners also got the vast majority of their income from live events, including country singer Kenny Chesney, the Rolling Stones, and Billy Joel. About 53% of Hillary Clinton's campaign contributions in March came from Wall Street, up from 32% last year. Many Wall Street donors shifted their funding from after Republicans Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Chris Christie dropped out of the race. Presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump, by contrast, hasn't received more than 1% of Wall Street's total contributions. And we'll finish with a quote from Shostakovich. When a man is in despair, it means that he still believes in something. Well, we're out of time for today's show. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.